Blog Talk Radio.
There, how you doing? Boy, this is an interesting week for me. I'm celebrating a birthday tomorrow, which is Sunday the 13th. And you know, birthdays most of the time it's like, yeah, another year gone, whatever. But for some reason, this year has been a bit of a challenge on a number of fronts. I've been somewhat self-employed for the last couple of years, and I tell you, the economy is up and down and can be a bit of a whirlwind at times. And so I'm very introspective lately and going, what's going on here? What's all this is working out or whatever. So anyhow, I hope you're doing well. I was hoping to get my room broken down last week and get storage stuff unboxed and stuff, but turns out that we've had a severe heat wave in Northern California. We had like 3 days, almost 4 days in a row with triple digit, like 102 104, and I wilted in that heat. I was like, oh man. We're hoping for some less hot days that are more comfortable, and it looks like we're headed for that. So what's going on here? You know, I recently posted a very interesting photograph of the Giza Plateau that was taken in 1904 from a gentleman in a balloon, and it raised quite a bit of question. In fact, we had on the international Facebook page for Earth Ancients, we had over 15,000 people take a look at that and go, wow, it's crazy. And what's unique about the photograph is it shows quite definitive evidence of a receding water line. And it it's not clear enough to see how high it might have gone on the pyramid, if there's any watermarks that are left on the pyramid, if there's any if there's any evidence of how high the water was. But it was interesting, I posted that photograph because I had also posted a photograph of an illustration that actually showed, it was someone created a photograph, an illustration, a fake image of water line, or an actual, it was the water had risen up to the middle of the Sphinx, and the illustrator illustrated the water up to many, 40, 50 feet on the pyramid. And in this illustration, there's a guy in a boat, and you can see underneath the Sphinx, and it just caused everyone to go, whoa. I mean, everyone was thinking, hey, maybe that's the way it was. So I was kind of searching to see, get a follow-up, if there was any imagery of that area, the Giza Pyramid. And what I've found in my search, in my own research, is that photographs taken before any excavations are done of any sites are usually very revealing. They're revealing because you can get a sense of what the state of the ruin is. Like I've done this throughout the Yucatan Peninsula in Central America when I've gone into the jungles and gone on excavations and explorations with groups. But when you look at these photographs, these early photographs, and I kind of reference this one photograph of the Giza Pyramid taken in 1904. I have seen a number of photographs of Mayan ruins that were taken in 1890s through the early 1900s, where the site hasn't been excavated yet. And you can see how the stones were laid to rest, what may have happened to topple the stones. In a lot of cases, these pyramids are piles of rocks. The force of some geological event has toppled them. Could be an earthquake, could be wind, doubtful. But my belief is that there was water. It was undulating water pushing and knocking these buildings down. And the photograph that I posted, Giza Plateau 1904, really shows from an elevated view water that is receding. You can see the sand being pushed, and the local mounds and terrain has been by the force of the water. And I haven't had a geologist comment on it, but there's a number of people that are engineers who believe that what we're looking at is pretty good evidence for water moving in and out of the Giza Plateau. So look at that. It's on Facebook, Earth Ancients. Go to the group page. And both the illustration of the Giza Plateau underwater and the actual evidence that I believe is of water damage and water receding from the Giza Plateau are posted there. So take a look. It's kind of interesting that if you've been following the news, Murdoch, the tabloid news king, purchased National Geographic last week. And most people would think, oh, that's bad news for the National Geographic because that means that's going to go commercial and you're not going to be able to get the good reporting and so on and so forth. My belief is that I think it's a good thing because I think institutions like National Geographic and the Smithsonian are not only not reporting important anomalous events, they are painting the picture of ancient world pretty flatly. And in the case of the Smithsonian Institute, we all know that they are on record of taking the skeletal remains and burying them in their vaults somewhere for no one to ever look at again. I believe that although the National Geographic doesn't have the sheer size of the institute in Washington, D.C., I think that they are to be viewed as wrongfully covering things up, covering discoveries up, and poo-pooing important discoveries, painting them with an eye towards academic science, where they should look at things a little closer. I mean, I've seen and read various articles on the Yucatan Peninsula, where I've spent a great deal of time. They haven't really covered this discovery. The new discovery of a river and a cenote underneath the pyramid, the El Castillo, the castle, the one of the most widely seen pyramids in Central America and Mexico. I think that just that they'd rather glaze things over. They don't want to be and they don't want to risk discussing things that call history into question, call our current science understanding into question. And I just think that Murdoch may break some of this open and force some new writers to come in. Maybe people who are scientists, people like Graham Hancock, could write for the National Geographic. I would love to see an article from people like that. So I stopped purchasing National Geographic 20 years ago because I just couldn't deal with it anymore. Their point of view was just too, for lack of a better word, constipated. There wasn't much of interest for me. So anyhow, that's kind of interesting to think about. Murdoch buys National Geographic. We'll see what happens. So my guest today is Patrick Chouinard. I've had Patrick on before, and he has written a book called Forgotten Worlds. I had him on earlier where he was speaking about the giants, the ancient world of giants. And that was a few months ago that it was last year. And this is an interesting interview. I actually recorded this yesterday because Patrick has to do a conference this morning. So, but this is fairly interesting. I'm going to go ahead and play it now. It's pretty long, and I'll come back and catch you in a bit. Today, my guest is Patrick Chouinard. We've had Patrick on before. He wrote a book on giants. And that was about a year ago that we had him on talking about giants. But he has actually written a book called Forgotten Worlds a few years ago. And with all the unique discoveries that have been in the news lately, I thought it was appropriate to bring him on. And as it turns out, he reached out to me and said, "Hey, Cliff, I've made some new discoveries. I've written an article here and there." And so I thought it was appropriate. Now, for you out there who don't remember, Patrick's a writer. He's a freelance journalist. He's the former producer of Archaeology TV, and he's the editor of New Archaeology Review. And in a second here, we'll ask him what he's been up to. But the book that we talked about last year was called Lost Race of Giants. And that was an interesting dive into not only American giants that are found in the United States, but European, actually worldwide giants. And that book was quite unique. We had a lot of interest in that. And it was funny because it seems like last year was the year of people writing about giants. We had Richard Dewhurst on, whose book was actually very, very well received in the media. And then we had Patrick's book. And then there was a couple other people that wrote books on giants. And so giants were in the news. In fact, we had just a few weeks ago, we had Zimmerman on the program, who speaks of the ancient American, the mounds and the giants that were found in these mounds. But Forgotten Worlds is a unique book, and I'm glad that Patrick could join us today. So we're going to get an update on things. So Patrick, welcome to the program. How are you doing today?
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here with you and your listeners today.
Okay, great. Hey, you know, let's talk about this great book. It's really fairly well researched. You go into a number of areas, a number of parts of the world, talking about links to Atlantis, to lost civilizations, and to what appears to be a connection from a prehistoric people that have left their mark in the ruins that they've left behind, but also in a lot of artifacts. Can we let's talk about this book. What was the motivation? What was the original motivation to write a book about the connection of Atlantis to and other lost civilizations?
Well, initially, my main focus was to detail the latest discoveries at that time, back in 2011 when I started writing the book, what was going on at that time in discovery, and also to basically summarize to some point all the previous theories and agenda on ancient civilizations, lost civilizations, and ancient mysteries that have been known to date. I began to formulate my ideas about this lost culture, which was fairly unique at this time, but I did not yet know how or to what extent this culture existed, or had a general idea or a clear idea of what actually I was getting at the time. But as time went on, as I started writing Lost Race to the Giants and continued to research as I traveled during this period, this three-year lull in my history, it was actually not a lull at all. I was traveling worldwide, going to India and Peru and several other places, and then living and studying in Tallahassee for some time after that. I came back to this area in the last few months, back in January, and then began to seriously put together the works I had been reading, and then the my own agenda that I've developed over the past few years into a fairly cohesive format for a new agenda entirely, a new theory of a lost race. And this is in competition with the lost race of the aliens, the ancient aliens theory, which states that all these great myths and traditions that we have of a lost race of gods who came to the earth and seeded mankind and had everything to do with our civilization and culture. I'm starting to say that this race did exist in ancient times, and I'm not discounting ancient theory, ancient alien theory altogether, but I'm saying the majority of what we know was a lost earthborn race.
Okay, well, that's actually in line with what Graham Hancock presents in Fingerprints of the Gods, and the new book, as I understand it, Magicians of the Gods, is that it's not so much the alien approach or the ancient aliens. It's that we have very few details, written form, of this once, you know, great race that was here, you know, 9,500 or 10,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So in your book, Forgotten Worlds, the opening has this amazing chronology of the history. And I want you to talk a little bit about this. I'm going to give some points, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about them. You go back to the birth of the universe, to Earth, the chronology of Earth. You go down, and then at 3.1 million years ago, you have the first upright walking humanoids that are discovered. And then at 900,000 years ago, you find evidence for the first Northern Europeans. Can you talk a little bit about the Northern Europeans and the discoveries that you have made?
The first Northern Europeans were not as we would describe Northern Europeans today as being tall and fair and blonde and blue-eyed or fair-skinned at all. They were more of an Africanoid type creature known as the Homo antecessor, and that was related to Homo heidelbergensis. Excuse me, that name is. it was a race that basically evolved out of the original peoples of southern Spain who had migrated from Africa around a million years ago or so, and then eventually made their way into Great Britain. There is evidence in recent finds of their technology and fire pits, of their projectiles, and their presence. There was very little, however, evidence of their biology, very little of their bones found or anything. There was more of an extensive understanding that they are linked possibly to Homo antecessor, but also possibly another race entirely. Now, I must also point out the fact that we say that there could be another race making these fire pits in these projectiles also goes to the fact that when you deal with fossil records, you're not always dealing with a complete story. There's always people there in that time period that existed that they didn't die and go through the fossilization process. So we have races, species that existed during those times that we know nothing about. So for all intents and purposes, those projectiles could be giant projectiles. They could be of another race entirely. It could even be part of a ancient, Nordic bloodline going back 100,000, 200,000, 1 million, 200 million, 300 million years, as Michael Cramer has shown in his research. So I want to say cautiously that there's a lot of evidence of habitation 900,000 years ago in Great Britain and the North Sea, but no evidence specifically of what exactly on Earth those ancient creatures or the ancient human-like creatures were that were making those that technology possible.
Right. No, it's interesting, and I brought up that chronology for the simple reason that people like Edgar Cayce talk about three phases of Atlantis. One very early phase that approximates about 100,000 years ago, when they were not very sophisticated, and then there was a destruction, and then there was a second phase, and then there was a destruction, and then there was a third phase, which was a phase where Plato comes into scene, and that was like apparently 28,000 years ago. But in your chronology, do you find that any of the dates that you have correspond to any of the known or legacy or mythology of Atlantis and the time dates that might have been presented?
I think most of my evidence basically goes with more recent findings and more recent theories and more recent mythology, specifically Mata Blavatsky's theories. It's very much in tune with those. And Blavatsky saw a massive period of not only human and Atlantean rises and falls, but also that of previous creatures that also existed on this planet. It's very much in line with the findings of Michael Cramer. Michael Cramer was a big inspiration for me, and I took what he said in a certain vein and began to expand on those theories. I have taken a lot of which Graham Hancock had talked about, Andrew Collins, and expanded on their views, and they have expanded on mine, because even you mentioned the giants. I started talking about giants 5 years ago on Coast to Coast, long before there was any talk of giants in this community. But then when I was doing my research, I stood by the wayside and watched a lot of my theories talked about. But however, I think that that we're getting to a very exciting time in research. I think Mary Sutherland, for one thing, who I've been talking to this morning, has touched upon a lot of things that are very similar to my ideas, and we plan on doing some collaborations in the future. But some of the things that I've discussed in this new book, Gods, Giants, and the Lost Empire, include a idea that I have for the fact that there's a lot of tree symbolism in mythology. We have Yggdrasil, we have the Garden of Eden, and the knowledge of the Tree of Good and Evil. Now, one of the interesting things about this is what was actually the great crime or the great sin of the Tree of Knowledge? Was it really a physical fruit, an actual fruit that was taken from a physical tree that was forbidden? Or was it something else? Was it the genetic tree that we were talking about? There is evidence that from our own DNA that we interbred with non-human races extensively. And we also know that the Greys themselves, the aliens who visit this planet, I believe they do, and I believe they are real, have done a lot of sexual and genetic experiments on humans. We also know that there is a great new discovery that is changing our view of humanity itself, and that's DNA. Why not, when they say tree, are they not referring to the genetic tree, the tree of humanity? And this great crime was an interbreeding with a non-human race, Neanderthals or some other. We know that the Hebrew word for the serpent is Nahostra, the Enchanter. It has nothing to do with there actually being a serpent. That was how we later interpreted or translated the Bible. But the original Hebrew room was Nthastra, the Enchanter. And I believe that this Enchanter was another race, possibly a Neanderthal or a giant, who then tempted Eve, who was of a different bloodline, to interbreed with that race. And that Cain was an offspring of this interbreeding. We also know that what is the story of the Garden of Eden? Is it really the story of a 6,000-year-old world now transformed? And, as we believe with just, I mean, the whole question is, and inherit the wind was, if Cain, there's this Cain and Abel and Adam and Eve, where did Cain's wife come from? Well, there was, as a story, the Bible is a story of the original Adamic bloodline, a single aspect, a single creation of modern humanity that we call the Adamu. But the whole story itself, the idea of Cain, is that there were other races outside. There were other bloodlines that he was to follow and find a wife with. So there was, there were other people on the earth, other races, other species, other groups of people on the earth at that time. And we hear from the Babylonian and the Mesopotamian, even the Arabian mythology of the jinn, or the genie, who were a great race of superior giant people who were asked to bow before mankind, who was now to be the new god on earth. And they refused. Okay. So they were dethroned from their reign of existence on earth. And we know that from biblical mythology, we know of Lucifer, the light bearer, and the fall from grace, and the fallen angels. And we hear of the Nephilim, who were the product of fallen angels and the daughters of men. So we know that there was a lot of symbolism there too.
Okay. That's fascinating, but let's keep on this timeline real quickly, because I have a couple other points that you make, and one of them is really interesting that would maybe correlate with a period in Atlantean history, which is you show the time of Ra, which was 50,000 years ago on your timeline. Can you tell us a little bit about Ra? Now, wouldn't that be a potential period, because Ra is considered an Egyptian god? But to a lot of people, he was probably, he may have been an Atlantean, or he may have been from a superior race or something like that. But that whole pre-dynastic period is very powerful in Egyptian history. Tell us a little bit about Ra.
Yes, the time of Ra was also just prior to the time of the Companions of Horus. And this was a time when the Mediterranean, as we know it, was no longer, well, it was not yet a sea, vast plain, and Egypt at that time was vastly different. There were forests, and there were great rivers and lakes, and this was a time of great superiority. There was a great race upon the earth who had built monuments which are now no longer in existence, and that what we see now as Sphinx and the pyramids were just the threshold of that end of that age, just the very remnants of that society then built the Sphinx 5,000, 10,000 years ago, and then began to create the Great Pyramids. This race was also the race that we see, this final end of that race was the race that built Göbekli Tepe and some of the great monuments, Baalbek and so forth and so on. And I believe that the giants of my own vision were a part of this process. I don't believe that they were actually the builders of those monuments, but I believe that mankind, the ones who were involved with this period known as the Age of Ra, were then being inspired and being taught the basis of civilization by the giants around that time. So this was a time, the time where the children of Ra, the birthplace and the birth existence of the superior human bloodline, which I call the Terran race, was being born at this time, being taught by the gods, basically, how to live their lives and how to exist. And so this period of the great reconciliation between God, giant, and men was very important. And a lot of the myths and traditions we get in both Mesopotamia and Egypt were formed during this ancient period.
That's fascinating. I have to ask you, you list a chronology for 58,000 years ago, and in that time frame, and I need you to talk to us about this is in your book, It's an anomalous artifacts are discovered in Colorado. Now, what is unique about that discovery that it had to be placed on your timeline?
Well, one of the things around this discovery in Colorado was a fact that there were actual, how we say, projectiles and points. They were to predate the Clovis first theory, which only dates to 14,000 years ago, by many decades, by many thousands of years. And so this whole idea of the Clovis first theory, which says that humans came across the Bering Strait only 14,000 years ago, was then disproven wholeheartedly by this. This period in Colorado also showed there were also some discoveries during this period of vast human habitation in North America, bones, projectiles, and ancient artifacts, which, you know, predating our civilization, actually link into some of the myths and traditions of ancient giants that were found by the Smithsonian that were then covered up by the Smithsonian because they did not fit our general idea of what history should be. You have to understand that there was a lot of elitism going on, and there still is, and anything that threatened elitism is self-protection. They want to eliminate anything that threatens their own existence. That's just human nature, if you ever wonder why they would go to such extent to cover it up. But anyhow, the whole point is that around that time, great discoveries were being made, at least discoveries we made in the 20th century that date back to that time period, that really hit home to prove that there was no Clovis first culture, as mainstream archaeologists seem to insist upon still. You can see that they were actually proceeding with their discoveries and finding out that there were boats coming off the coast of Western North America and different forms of migrations. But when the evidence was so unsurpassing as to the relevancy of the other theories, it seems that about a month ago they came out with a new announcement that all those theories were wrong. We know that they came 14,000 years ago across the Bering Strait, really. After all that evidence and all that researchers like Shirley McIntyre down in Mexico, that all of a sudden that's all gone, all that research that they found, all that genetic evidence which still exists and still is provable, Kenoic man, just to name but a few, spirit caveman, now all that's wrong, and we know that they all came with just a few people across the Bering Strait 14,000 years ago to an ice corridor, mind you, that didn't even have any form of sustenance. There would be no way that a culture could go through that ice corridor for a few thousand years and survive in that ice-free corridor with no vegetation and no wildlife. It's impossible, and they know it's impossible, but they continue to preach this in the schools and everything and expect us to follow. That's unfortunate as well.
It stretches things a lot. The area in your book that I think is great is that you touch upon different countries around the world. You go into Mexico, Japan, Europe, South America, the Americas, Northern America, North America, and you give reference. For me, in my travels in recent Mexico, I think there's conclusive evidence that a lot of Maya technology, as well as Aztec history, comes from a place called Atlan, or Atlantis is what I believe. And if you go to various northern Yucatan ruins, a lot of their buildings are very, in some ways, kind of like similar to some of the early Greek structures that you find in Europe. What did you find in Mexico was a connection? Was there a correlation that you were able to
it's amazing when you have the theory of the great white god, of the great fair-skinned giants and creatures from out beyond the sea coming to teach them the rudiments of civilization. There's not only a strict Atlantean connection, but there's also even a Northern European connection. We hear that in ancient Mayan and Aztec mythology, there is the god VOTAN, V-O-T-A-N, in our own language, or, you know, when you say VOTAN, you're talking about Wotan, the king of the gods in ancient Norse mythology. And you have also the term Atlan is almost identical to Atlantis. And there is other, one of the things, too, is that the Mormons have the belief in, Jesus being Quetzalcoatl and Viracocha and also Kublai Khan. Now, the interesting thing about this is that we know that from research that there were Christians in China, and that some of the people of this American period, had come from China. And we know that there's a lot of evidence to say that they beat Columbus during the early 15th century to America some several decades before and started settling in the Aztec area. And it actually, the Aztec civilization was fairly briefly created. That's just one theory. But to only go with that specific theory, you might say that some of the Christian symbolism actually came from the Chinese, who inherited that from the Nestorian Christians, who in turn were the basis of the Prester John theory. And also we know that there were Jews in China as well. So we know that a lot of that symbolism could have come from that too. However, I believe that, on the contrary, the main symbolism in South American and North American lore is that a great white god or a great fair-skinned group of people had come to the United States, to North America and South America, and created culture. We know that there are legends all over ancient North America of red-haired giants, the Paiutes, and Tsi-Ka, one of their races of red-haired giants, is only the tip of the iceberg with their discussions. And we know that when Ponce de Leon came over, and Pizarro, and De Soto, what they found in North America and South America were a race of red-haired giants still alive, still. Patagonia is only a perfect example. Patagonia is land of the great giants. And so we see all over tradition from the first explorers of seeing these Caucasian-like red-haired giants all over. There was even in off the coast of California a great group of people who showed unique Caucasian-like traits, however, looked somewhat different than Europeans. And I think there's even a possibility of a proto-Caucasoid race in which many of the Japanese in the Jomon of ancient Japan and Korea were descended from. I believe that there were, and it was an ancient race of red-haired peoples dating back many thousands of years, 12,000, 15,000 years. And this basically is the race, the full human race, that many of the research proves. You know, the Caucasian mummies of China could have been a later remnant of this race, and the fact that Andrew Collins and Graham Hancock have touched upon a lost race, I believe that this could have been not only a lost race of humans, the Adamu, but also the Terran race and the inheritors of the giant civilization who were their gods and their leaders.
You know, it's really funny because when I was and have continued to travel through Mexico, a lot of the local cities have small museums. I see continually the skeletal remains of what can only be considered a longhead race, attributed to natural DNA, RNA, natural growth, not headbound. And you can tell just because of the way their heads are. And it's my thinking, and the longheads are all over the place. They're in South America. They've now been found in literally every country in the world. It seems like that is a race that died out. And in the ruins, I can name three: Ekbalong, which is a city in northern Yucatan, and at the Uxmal, the city south of Mérida, and even in small ruined cities like, I think they found a skull in Chichen Itza. These individuals were identified to the point where they must have been a strain of human that not only had superior intelligence, but they were probably in roles of government, leadership, perhaps even priests. And it seems to me like this must have been an offshoot of who we are today.
This is very interesting, and I want to get into this if you don't mind for a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
Brian Forrester, who studies the elongated skulls, and I had a great conversation about this a few years ago, just before I went to Peru, and it was a discussion about the elongated skulls being a lost race of giants and being an elite form of humanity that once existed and was the rulers of a primitive or growing humanity, a humanity that was then evolving into what it is now. And I believe that, you know, even in the ancient Indian myths, they speak of, they had the Varna, which means color, but it also means type. And Varna is the caste system. And they were very adamant about separating the groups together and making the caste system pure. And so even this was basically the inheritor of what they call the Aryans, not the blonde, blue-eyed Nazi Aryans that we all think of, but Aryans as the ancient people who we inherited our Indo-European tongue from. Indo-Europeans, we don't know where they came, we have a problem figuring out how the language evolved, where this language actually came from. So wouldn't it be interesting to say that this lost, elongated skull, this neat group of red-haired, elongated skulls giants who were the masters of the earth at one time, and our impression of what gods were, had come to India and given them the language of the Aryans. And the Aryans were not, so we don't really know who the Aryans were, we only know of their culture, their language, and what they did in India and the mythology regarding them. We don't have any real evidence of who the Aryans were, other than mythology. So one of the Aryans were actually the elongated skull people, just one particular name for that lost race in Eurasia, which then gave the Indians and the Europeans their tongue, and were the founders of that civilization in Persia, and that the Aryans, this great race of red-haired, blonde giants with elongated skulls and a superior technology. What if this race of giants, we know from Indian mythology, from Hindu mythology, that there were great discussion of the varieties and types of humanity that existed at that time. And they described beings that were giant, elongated skull beings ruling as the gods, including Indra. We also know that because there's such discussion about this variety of humans, it seems to basically wipe out any discussion of what we consider human diversity today. We know that prior to the bottleneck event, which happened around 100,000 years ago, there's a mass extinction of nearly every human being on the planet, including all the proto-humans. And then after that period, there was a period where there was just a few survivors, like almost like there was a Noah, and that the great flood had occurred, wiped out virtually every aspect of humanity, and the few survivors then carried on that tradition. Well, out of that bottleneck, there is 1% diversity in our population today. Every single massive difference in human populations today only equals a 1%. So if all that massive diversity is only 1%, we know that before the bottleneck, from examining the human genome, that there was a 13% level of diversity. So if all that diversity on this planet is 1%, that 13% must have been staggering, and this accounts for all the other varieties of humans that could have existed prior to that time, and accounted for many of the differences in human conditions that we see in our mythology, of the vast, you know, blue skin, green skin, the elongated skull people, the giants, the serpentine, the Rahastras of India, and the serpentine people that once existed at that time too. There's vast possibilities of the diversity that we can't calculate it at this time. And then when you factor in all the other forms of humanity, of mankind, of different types of creatures that could have existed back then, that left no fossil record and no genetic record, in the sense that they didn't pass on what they have, what they were, to another generation, simply because there was such a mass extinction that those populations went extinct. So here at the end of the story, we have a very less diverse, a very highly populated world that has somehow, through that great cataclysm some 12,000 years ago, has lost every single knowledge of that great prehistory that once was so massive that we can't even conceive of it in our wildest imaginations.
Yeah, it's fascinating. What do you think the reason is for organized science to not dissect one of these unusual long-headed individuals? The theory of head binding only goes so far. I mean, some of these people have documented brain capacity of between 25% and 30% more brain mass than we do today. And there's other things that have been by pathologists, as an example, there a lot of these longhead races are taller than we are today. They have an extra rib. They have, in some cases, an extra vertebrae. They have.
You know, that's fascinating. I want to say real quickly that in the old tradition of the Bible, it was Adam who had an extra rib, and then when they created woman, they removed one of those ribs and used that to form.
Yeah.
Steve, isn't that amazing?
Yeah, you're right. You know? That's a good point. It's just very odd, because 20 years ago, I knew about the long heads. 20 years ago, when I was traveling and researching in Mexico, I'd see these amazing skulls in museums, small local museums that were situated very close to ancient Mayan cities. And when they finally excavated Ekbalam in Yucatan, here in this beautiful top of a pyramid is these stucco sculptures, which many of them, the figures look like they're from India, but here is this one special figure who stands at the very corner looking down at whoever looks up with his long head with wings in the back and things like that. It's an obvious individual who was deified to a point, or maybe he wasn't, like I said, an important individual. But, it really rings home the fact that these long heads were special beings, and why we have not had more research done on them. I know Brian Forrester tries to get DNA studies. My wish would be for him to really step up, because he's a Paracas area of Peru. Doesn't he work with the local government and say, look, I want to have a complete study of this skeleton, and I want to do it officially. I want to have you sanction it. Then we can get to the root of the problem. I think he's kind of doing things backwards by sending DNA studies to the states. I mean, they can be contaminated. He's not a scientist. He doesn't, I mean, it's just, drives me nuts. But I just think there should be more.
They found another elongated skull remains. What was it, a Mayan pyramid recently?
Six,
7-8 months ago, was it? Back when I had a discussion with you about giants last December, we discussed that, but there was a find just about that time of an elongated skull in a Mayan pyramid.
I haven't read about any elongated skulls recently, but I do know that there was a grave site in northern Yucatan. I think it was about 20 miles from Chichen Itza, which is kind of central Yucatan, where they found a grave site with lots of these individuals. I mean,
last November or December they discovered that, didn't they?
I think so. Yeah. It's funny how these things, when they're discovered, you hear about them, and then all of a sudden it's kind of squelched, which kind of bothers me. It's like, why don't we hear more What's the follow up? Let's travel out to Japan. Now you're quite focused on the Yanagumi monument.
Yes.
This is a structure that Graham Hancock has outlined quite a bit. Also, Dr. Robert Schock, the geologist, who claims that it's natural. I don't know how he can claim it's natural. It looks like it's definitely been man-made. But tell us a little bit about what you've discovered.
Well, I know Robert Schock. He's a brilliant man, but he likes to save his own ass a little too much from the mainstream. That's his only problem. And I shouldn't say that because he's a friend, but he does try to save his own ass too much, and that's,
he did write that's the by the way, people listening, he Robert Schock wrote a glowing, fantastic introduction to this book we're talking about today for Forgotten Worlds. The introduction is impressive on
yes,
his belief in Atlantis, but the what is it about the Yanagami monument that you found unique and potential link to an Atlantis?
Well, only because the fact that it was not an isolated discovery. Because if you read Graham Hancock's book Underworld, which I read in one sitting down back in when it first came out, I think it was back in 1999 or so. When it first came out, I had it down in one sitting, and that basically is the book. It was actually his writings that enticed me to get involved with ancient mysteries, because I was doing a show, Archaeology TV, at the time that was clearly mainstream in its approach. I was dealing with people from USF, and so was the New Archaeology Review right then. When it started, it was a very mainstream publication. Well, once upon reading Graham Hancock's work, and then reading Tangled of the Gods, which came out a few years before Underworld, then I became convinced that this was, in fact, the way to go. And so when I read this, I really realized that there was more to the story than just one little tiny isolated incident. There were all over that whole area, all over the China Sea, there were locations where there were, you know, anomalous structures. And what I thought about it is the thing that Robert Schock just doesn't touch upon, and it's very obvious. Anything would look natural if it's given so many thousands of years of weathering under the sea and on the surface. I mean, if Graham Hancock is correct, and this is indeed a very, very ancient structure, and there was not only weathering under the ocean and great decay, there was also great weathering for, 10,000 years on the surface of the structure being on the surface. So this is, that is clear. And I want to point out also that people say, well, where's the evidence of Atlantis? Why isn't there more structures that exist from 28,000 years ago? Well, just think, look how you take the pyramids, look how weathered they are, or some of these structures that exist today. Can you imagine a 28,000 year structure and the technology that once existed then, and then the possibility at some say that there was a nuclear war? Do you think that there would be very, very much left over from that period? Yet here was a structure so fantastically built that it just defies human description. And I just looked at that picture and looked at that and said, there's absolutely no way in humanity that this could be a mere normalized artificial natural structure, that it had to be by its very nature and significance and location of artificial origin and of great significance, the theory of Lemuria and Mu and the lost civilization. So then as time went on, I started figuring that out and started adding to my own theories and believe that the red-haired race had built that as well. And I started to believe that it was Asia that was, in fact, the homeland of this great race and the original homeland of the ancient peoples who later settled Mesopotamia and became the ancient Hebrews, thus creating the mythology of ancient Judaism and Christianity, and also the Epic of Gilgamesh with Eden. You must note that the word Eden in ancient Babylonian is not paradise or garden. It is steppe, the steppes, or the steppes of Russia and Central Asia. And here we have in the Terra mummies the exemplification of this red-haired, tall race, which could be the ancestors of the later peoples who came after that. And so we could see that maybe the beginnings of Eden were in the Tarim Basin region. We know that there were vast lakes, and there was a great area where the Himalayas kind of encased that area. We know that around 10,000 years ago, there was a great, at the end of the last ice age, there was a great flooding of most of Asia, which could equally, as much as the Black Sea flooding, you know, incorporate the myth of great floods. You know, even in India, they talk about the great floods, and that their Noah's Ark was not atop Mount Ararat, but atop the Himalayas. So this fact that, especially in Eurasia, the myths of this great flood are so, you know, they exist so widely. Then you have to ask, we have a theory about people coming across the Bering Strait and along the coast of North America from the ancient Asia. Well, it's indeed a Proto-Caucasoid race, or an ancient red-haired race that once existed there, and there's evidence of red-haired peoples in North America and legends which correspond with the Eurasian and European legends and the North African legends. Then somehow the people who did come from that area migrated to North America and brought with them those traditions. So that there tells us that Kaogman was probably indeed Caucasian and came from that same basis in that Karen Basin region that once was a home to the primitive Adamu race, or the Terran race.
Well, let me ask you a little bit. Let's stay in Asia for a minute. So in your book, you outline quite a bit about the fairly recent discovery, these Caucasian mummies. And some of the mummies are red, and some of them light-headed, light-haired. What is important about that? First of all, it was an anomalous discovery. But secondly, they're wearing some sophisticated jewelry, number one. And number two, I think they left enough for us to see that they were not a simple people. They may have migrated from some other part in Asia. So what's unique about those mummies?
Are you referring to the Caucasian mummies of China?
Yeah.
Yes. It's very interesting. I believe that the people in the Tarim Base were basically the Adamu. As Zachariah Sitchin says, that there were humans created in Babylonia to serve the aliens. I believe that this great race, this greater elongated skull race, was using genetics to manipulate and create a sister or children race to them. That's why the first peoples had red hair and were light-skinned, because they were the creations of the light-skinned elongated skull race. It took genes from Africa and other races and other groups and started creating the basis of Middle Eastern and European life. And that this was the homeland, the original homeland of the Near Easterns and then later the Europeans. We know that in European genetics, we study and find out that somewhere around 6,000 years ago, there was a massive flooding from the Middle East and from the Central Steppes into pre-Aryan Europe, then taking over pre-Aryan Europe and mixing that bloodline with the existing European group of people, which were the people I described in Forgotten Worlds as possessing technology during the 900,000 year range. Those people were then overtaken by the Aryan or Terra mummies people who were coming over. And then also we have evidence that there is a third bloodline. Now, this third bloodline, known as the Bacall people, were a group of people who are ancestral to both Europeans and Middle Eastern peoples and the North American Native American population. This was just recently discovered, and I talked about it in an article I published in Ancient Magazine, the magazine of Wayne May and Frank Joseph. Most notably. Right. And so this is something I discussed there back in April 2014, and also talked about human diversity in the New World. So I wrote that when I was in Tallahassee last year. So this is something that is very interesting, and there's evidence as time goes on that more interbreeding with the Mongoloid peoples who originally came from Eastern Africa started mixing with the Tara Basin people, and their blood then became diluted. There is evidence that around 900 AD, the vast proportion of the Tara Mummy people were already interbred with the Asians or the Mongoloids pretty well. But there is evidence that prior to 9,000 years ago, most of the population of China, Northern Asia, and even Southern Asia was predominantly of a Caucasian nature around that time. That was the vast majority of their population. Then around 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago, a great change was eventually occurring as more alien blood was intermixing with the Caucasian population, but also we know that there was something else going on, something more significant than just interbreeding, that there was a concerted effort, by an outside source to manipulate the bloodline of the Asiatic peoples. And this is something that ties in with both my giant theory and also the theory of David Hatchett Childress and Georgios Sakalos in their alien theory. So it's now a point for the alien theorists and the giant theorists to then have a headway to start debating the issue about where this manipulation started to come from around 5,000, okay, 6,000 years ago.
Now, it's funny that you mention aliens, because I really like to talk about aliens, because I think ancient aliens has turned into a free-for-all to discuss ancient Earth. Anything that cannot be explained is automatically relegated to ancient aliens. But yeah, where I do delve to, I do bend, is on of Mars. And in his book, The Mars Mystery, Graham Hancock outlines and reveals that he believes there is a correlation and a connection between pre-dynastic Egypt and Cydonia Mars, the Cydonian region of Mars and just surrounding areas. And not only does he present compelling evidence of a humanoid race which could be our ancestors having come from the red planet Mars, but he shows not only an evidence of a sphinx, but a number of pyramids. And also on our program, we've had Dr. John Brandenburg, who has shown and reveals numerous megalithic artifacts, some miles and miles across, that are left from these people. So what is your feeling about that? What is your feeling about that connection?
You know, there could be a definite connection. I have not researched it that extensively. That's one of the few books by Graham Hancock, The Mars Mystery, that I didn't read extensively. However, I do know that in evolution there is something called convergence. Are you familiar with that?
Convergence?
Yes.
No.
Convergence is where you have a similar culture or a similar situation evolution-wise with similar characteristics of a culture, and that independently those two cultures then converge into a single or similar situation, a similar characteristic, and look very much similar and do very similar things. The example of this locally in the European Terran area is the Celts and the Germans and the Slavs. They equally had Indo-European ancestors, but look more correctly the same in their cultural similarities, largely because of their similar situations, their similar environment allowed many of the same myths and traditions to evolve independently because of their evolutionary similarities. This is something like, for instance, if all three groups are forest people, then their religion is going to start to evolve around forest lines. If they are all tribal people, then they, as a system, is going to be on tribalism and warfare and the warrior ethic. I mean, we can even see that there are similarities with this between black African traditions in Germanic traditions. Now, how is there going to be similarities between Black African traditions and Germanic similarities when there was a bottleneck, a second bottleneck in Europe 10,000 years ago that would vastly separate an African and a German. But there are similarities there because there is a similarity in situation and environment. We know that at one time, Mars had an environment very similar to Earth, and we know that it's a very closely related planet. So there's very similarities that there could have been a form of convergence there. Similar life forms under a similar condition evolving along similar lines. The question is, was there any travel at that time between the two worlds? Well, I think that the giants, this lost civilization, had space-faring technology. I think they were extremely advanced, had genetic manipulation technology, just as they envisioned the ancient aliens as having that. So if there was space travel, then that also brings in Graham Hancock's theory to say that there were not only travel between the two worlds, but that the ancient alien theory has a lot of clout in the sense that these could not only be travelers from Earth, it could be time travelers from a different dimension. So that's all falls into the same category if you just bring up ancient giants.
Yeah. What are some of the new bits of evidence? And now you talk a little bit, because your book came out in 2012. But since that time, places like Göbekli Tepe have come on board. You mentioned Caral in Peru and Pio. Can you talk a little bit about how those may relate to an advanced civilization and possibly have a connection with Atlantis?
Yes, Caral was an ancient civilization that dates back to comparably to Stone Age times in Europe and back to the pre-archaic period of South American tradition, and it had absolutely no pottery and no form of metallic technology, but had many, many different aspects of technology that were improvised. You know, primitive technology that was used in very fantastic ways, and it was a vast pyramid that was the largest pyramid known in America, or even larger than the pyramids, but unlike the pyramids of Egypt, which were very high, this was a very broad-based pyramid. It was extensive, and the strange thing is it looked, it was shaped a lot like Mount Olympus Mons on Mars. So giving a credit to Graham Hancock, it's amazing how much Caral resembles Olympus Mons in the way it is shaped. Caral was the oldest civilization ever found in the Americas, and I believe is the mother nation or the mother country of much of South and North America. I believe that through cultural interaction, the technology of Caral was then spread northward into first to Mexico and then into the rest of the United States at that time. It's very extensive, and they haven't found many writings there, and I'm just waiting for the time that they find script of some type that literally describes this ancient civilization. Now, as far as what was the other thing you were talking about, was the other civilization you had a question on?
Oh, it was South America. It was Tiwanaku.
Oh, Tiwanaku, yes. Tiwanaku, of course, Edmund Kiss was a member of the Schutzstaffel, the SS, and he was part of the Annenerbe, which was Himmler's platform for discovering ancient, what he called the Aryan civilization that existed thousands of years ago, and that his basic goal was the same thing as in Raiders of the Lost Ark, to seize that technology for the use of their government. But at any rate, he had sent Edmund Kiss there to discover Tiwanaku, or rediscover it in his view, and then he clearly stated that he believed that giants built Tiwanaku and dated the Gateway of the Sun, which was a great archway, to 28,000 years B.C., which is around the same time frame that Guido von List gave for the ancient Germans to exist in Central Europe. There was a there was a belief that at one time that that was a local coastal environment back when, like Mahalovsky talks about the Great Flood, before the whole Earth was reshaped around 20,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Yeah.
That's a little bizarre.
So tell us,
but anyhow.
Tell us a little bit about tell us a little bit about some of the new discoveries since the publishing of Forgotten Worlds. What else do you have in the few minutes we have left? I'm interested in learning kind of an update.
Yes, one of the new discoveries which I just saw is that they believe that there is a Earth within an Earth now, an Earth that lives on the mantle of our Earth below the current crust of the Earth. And this is very interesting, I think. And also, about a month after Forgotten Worlds was published, they discovered a hidden landmass off of Britain in the Atlantic, which existed 75 million years ago, and it was all but destroyed around 65 million years ago. It dates to 75 million years ago. It was far older. It was a lost continent, actually. And this has fueled my discussion about where the giants originally came from. Was it really Europe or Africa or somewhere that we readily can identify? Or was there this lost continent that was once the home and the ancestor of our Atlantean myth that was later destroyed? That, I think, is the most significant find over the past 3-4 years.
Wow. Okay, cool. All right. Well, hey, the book is... Forgotten Worlds. It is now. You're saying you're writing a book now that is kind of a prelude to the Forgotten Worlds book, right? Is that what you're telling us? Any of the program?
No, actually, it's a sequel to both Forgotten Worlds and Lost Race of the Giants.
It's a sequel. Okay.
Yeah, it actually touches upon many of the both the myths and discoveries discussed about in those two books, but then takes them to the next level.
Okay. Okay. Excellent. So, Forgotten Worlds, it's really kind of a nice overview with touches around the world of evidence of advanced civilizations, not only their ruined cities, but in many cases, Patrick shows us through artifacts, through whatever writings that are left, and then local folklore, their connection to civilizations. The more I research the subject of Atlantis, the more I kind of begin to think that Graham Hancock has it right, that perhaps 10,000 years ago and earlier, Atlantis was one of many sophisticated civilizations that were out there, and we don't have the evidence for the technology. Rumor had the Atlanteans use piezoelectric energy to power their machines and their cities and things like that, and it was one of the ultimate destructive forces of Atlantis itself. But it seems to me that wherever you look, wherever you can stretch your view, there's a lot of places that would fit under ancient, highly sophisticated civilizations. What would you say about that?
I would say that Graham Hancock is right on the money, that there were much more than just Atlantis or Lemuria, that this was a global civilization. And I take further steps in my new book to describe this global civilization and its origins and where it came from. I think that this idea of a superior technology as well being the downfall of that culture is very emblematic of our own civilization, because now we have technology that in turn can lead to the demise of our own.
It's, I don't know. I'm just hoping that we continue to find things. I will mention this, that Murdoch just bought National Geographic. They're not a nonprofit. So maybe that'll open the pearly gates to some of the discoveries that they've made.
Yes.
I don't think they keep skeletons as documented by the fact that apparently the Smithsonian has tons of relics that would actually show us that there were other races and other worlds walking the earth before our written history. But I think it's good news to hear that perhaps Murdoch will say, hey, you know, give us the full truth, not just the abridged addition to our history. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about that.
Let's hope so.
Yeah. Yeah. Patrick, what can we expect from you in the near future? Are you going to be speaking anywhere? Do you have a new website you want to promote while we've got you on the radio here?
Well, I'm just right now trying to get everything together. I've been out of commission now for 3 years. So just I'm working on a radio show right now with the horror writer R.J. Smith, Fright Fest. Mm-hmm. And because of my presence on the show, we also talk about ancient mysteries, UFOs, lost civilizations. And we have currently some plans to have some, including Stephen Myers, on the show and not so distant future. Okay. So just keep watching and keep looking, because a lot of new things are going to be coming out in the next few months. And just look for my name. It'll be there.
Fantastic. Hey, well, it's great talking to you. And when this new book comes out, definitely hear all about it.
Oh, that'll be great. Thank you very much.
Okay, so that was Patrick Chouinard. The book is Forgotten Worlds. You can get it on, let's see here, Amazon. Do a search and Forgotten Worlds. He's a good writer. He's a good researcher, and the material is solid, and I hope you enjoyed that that interview. I want to remind you that this coming up next week, I'm going to be doing interviews with Dr. John Brandenburg, who wrote Death on Mars. I had him on the program when his book was probably about 6 months to a year old. And he, following that interview, was featured on CNN and a number of major news outlets discussing his discovery of nuclear waste or a bomb residue in the atmosphere of Mars. And we're going to follow up. He's agreed to do a follow up interview with me next week, which I may broadcast Saturday, the following Saturday, which would be the 19th or maybe the 26th. I don't know yet. So that's something to stay tuned for, because to my mind, he is one of the most outspoken authorities, a nuclear fusion expert who has studied Mars with a number of groups, who can tell us about the ancient past of Mars. And I'm just curious. I'm going to have some questions about some of the comments that that NASA has made, as some other purported specialists who discount what he has said. The other person who will be on the program very quickly, maybe next week, maybe the week after, is the Native American Zuni elder, Clifford Mahuti, who is a Kachina rainbow elder, who speaks of an amazing place called Lemuria. And Lemuria is chronicled by Catherine Wood's book on Mu Lemuria, which came out in the 20s. Really, there hasn't been anyone else that has really spoken or written about it to any extensive degree. And Mahuti is going to present the Native perspective and some other opening aspects of how the people of Lemuria colonized the rest of the planet. So stay tuned for that. I'm looking forward to that interview, which will be next week, and we'll see when we can get it out. I'll make an announcement. As always, check our Facebook page, our Facebook, and then Earth Ancients, go to groups, and you'll see a number of the people that are interviewed and some of their content. All right. Well, have a great day, and we'll talk to you again next time.